Katie Couric, the anchor and managing editor of the CBS Evening News with Katie Couric, brings us the news, but she also occasionally makes news, as she did when she left the Today Show 5 years ago to become the first woman solo anchor of a network evening news program. And she's been in the news again recently in regard to what might be her next career move and for her new book, The Best Advice I Ever Got, Lessons from Extraordinary Lives, a collection of stories of setbacks and successes, winning and losing, and words of wisdom from over 100 people. It's published by Random House. I'm very pleased that it brings Katie Couric to our show today. Hello.
Hi, Leonard. Nice to see you. Timing is everything, right? The book comes out and all this other stuff is going on. So it's
been a bit crazy. You didn't know at the time that any of this stuff was in the works?
No. I didn't know. I would not have probably had these things coincide necessarily. But it is what it is, and I'm really excited about the book. And the best thing about it is that my proceeds go to an organization called Scholarship America, which is the largest nonprofit scholarship fund. It's given $2.4 billion to 1.7 million kids to go to college or stay in college since 1958. So I'm really thrilled to be able to pay it forward in this way.
Well, you probably could have written a whole book of advice and stories from your own life.
Why
did you decide to compile advice from other people instead?
Well, basically, the genesis of this was I gave a graduation address, as I often do. I usually do one a year. And last year, I gave it at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland. And I thought, gee, I've had this extraordinary career that has exposed me to so many fascinating people. From Queen Rania to Hugh Jackman to Sheryl Crow to Malcolm Gladwell, I've just had this wonderful opportunity to meet and get to know some of these people. So I thought I reached out to a few of them. I thought without being too name-droppy, it would be fun to tell these graduates what advice other people would give them. And I got some really very moving, inspiring things back. Queen Rania, for example, told a story about how King Hussein once sat with her and said to her, "What do you think of me?" And she thought, why would he want to know what I thought of him? And she said it was just such an example of his incredible humility that he always wanted to see himself through other people's eyes. And I thought, wow, that's a really valuable lesson for people. So I thought, I don't want just the kids at Case Western to hear these words of wisdom. Wouldn't it be wonderful to have other people, have them available to other people? So I cast a wide net. And about 116 people contributed to this book.
And have you interviewed all of them over the course of your career?
Not every one of them, but many of them I certainly have. And others I have just really admired through the years.
Well, there's a wide range. You've mentioned a few. There's also Mario Batali, Gail Collins, Meryl Streep, General David Petraeus.
Jimmy Carter, Bill Clinton, Larry David, Craig Ferguson, Ina Garten, Eric Schmidt from Google. I mean, Salman Rushdie has a very funny short entry about advice that he got that he's adhered to through the years. So it really is such a diverse group of people who are really doing so many different things that I think there's something in it for everyone.
And this sets you up for any number of commencement addresses into
it's already written. I'm actually giving the address at Boston University. And first, Queen Rania wrote some words of advice, and she said, make sure that other, like Katie, make sure other people write your speeches for you. So I have a built-in speech ready to go. I'm just going to read my book.
Are you going to do a commencement speech at CBS? There are reports that you'll be leaving CBS Evening News. Are you able to comment on what's happening?
I'm really not. You know, I'm sort of in the middle of negotiations. I can tell you I have a lot of opportunities. I'm very excited. But right now I'm really focused on the evening news. I just came back from Iraq doing a profile of Secretary of Defense Bob Gates, who is stepping down, I believe, or at least the speculation is that. He's expected to announce that in the near future. And I'm also working on another 60 Minutes piece and Sunday Morning Pieces, my weekly web show. So I'm very busy really focusing on my work right now. But no, I'm not really able to say what the future holds for me at this juncture, except to say I'm really excited about the future, wherever it takes me.
Well, anchors often wind up going to the place where stuff is happening. Is it really important? Because in the end, isn't your job largely to be able to read flawlessly?
I think it's a little more than
that, with all due respect. But I'm always amazed. How often do you flub?
Oh, a few times a night.
Really?
Thank you for not noticing, Leonard, if you've been watching.
Well, but I think about that a lot.
Clearly, I think reading a teleprompter is the least important part of the job. I think being a good journalist, helping to guide the broadcast, helping to select the stories, suggest stories. And I do think it's important to try to be at the scene of the action. I think that that informs the broadcast. It informs the coverage. You know, ideally, I think all the evening news anchors in the past and in the present have had a great deal of experience covering stories. And so you want to bring that experience to bear when you're doing an evening newscast. So to be able to go to Tahrir Square and understand the atmosphere and the motivation for the protesters there, and then conversely seeing the pro-Mubarak supporters come in and the conflict that surfaced as a result of that, or being able to go to Haiti and witness firsthand the devastation of an earthquake that killed 250,000 people, going to the Gulf and picking up the oil, which is the consistency of chocolate pudding, and talking about it and actually seeing the damage it's doing to the delicate estuaries and ecosystem, I think that it translates in the broadcast.
Because you are a representative of the audience as well as somebody
yes.
who's presenting.
Well, I think all journalists ideally are representatives of the audience that they're speaking to.
At one point in Cairo, you were surrounded by protesters and a number of reporters were attacked there, including your CBS colleague, Lara Logan. Did you have any problems? Did you ever worry for your safety?
Oh, yeah, of course. Yes, it was very concerning because it was sort of ironic, and Lara's doing well, and she's an incredibly courageous correspondent, but that was an awful thing that happened to her. That happened sort of during the night of jubilation after Mubarak stepped down. But I think at this mob mentality, and when you're in the middle of throngs of people where the energy is so high, you know, so high charged, you never know what's going to transpire. But the morning that it started to get incredibly dicey in Tahrir Square, when all these pro-Mubarak supporters were marching in there, they were harassing us. They were telling us we couldn't shoot any video with our camera. They were bullying us and threatening us. And at one point, I was just jostled a bit. But obviously, you know, some reporters and photographers, I spoke with some still photographers, were very poorly treated. And it was quite scary at times.
And then you have to go on the air and retain your focus.
Yeah, well, you know, I did not go into the square when the camels were charging in and the horses and the rocks were being thrown and pipes. And in fact, gunfire was going off. So basically, we did the broadcast from our setting. I interviewed somebody from the London Times or the Sunday Times of London about it. But, you know, you have to be cautious and smart when covering a story like that.
My guest is Katie Couric. She has a new book called The Best Advice I Ever Got, Lessons from Extraordinary Lives. It is published by Random House. You include advice from Laura Linney to never read your reviews. A lot of actors say that.
Yeah, I just interviewed Daniel Radcliffe, who's doing How to Succeed in Business, and I asked him about that. I read a Ben Brantley review that the wizard has chosen wisely when he decided to do Equus. And he said, I never read reviews. And he said the most harrowing experience of his life was when he Googled himself. He said it was like walking into a room full of people and having them all tell him how much they hated him. Mm-hmm. So he a lot of people don't do that.
Well, the big problem with checking out what people say about you on the internet is that the people who are likely to write on the internet are the ones who hate you.
Yeah, that's
the other
true.
Ones
They're
may
more
come
motivated.
Up to you
yeah.
on the street and say, Katie, I love you. But actors don't like to look at reviews, or many, because they feel that it influences their performances both positively and negatively. If the rave review says they delivered this line perfectly, well, they're very self-conscious the next time they deliver the line, and it works the other way as well. But what happens with somebody like you? You have to know what's going on. Were you prepared for the scrutiny and the criticism that followed when you became the solo anchor at CBS?
No, I have probably the honest answer is no. I mean, I knew I would be scrutinized. I think the degree under which I was scrutinized, probably I underestimated. But you know, I think that it was a very high-profile hire. I had been on the Today Show for 15 years, and a lot of people knew me well. I was a very familiar person. And I think that, you know, when somebody's a novelty, I was the first female solo anchor, I think it automatically opens you up to some criticism. And I think we tried to make some changes in the evening news, even if it was a little bit around the edges. But I think under the white hot light, I think we were a little cavalier. We'll try some things. We'll see what happens. Some may work, some may not. But I think we all underestimated under the bright, white light of scrutiny that we experienced, that it would be hard to kind of experiment. And, if I had to do it over again, I've said before that probably we would have made the changes a little more slowly so people could feel comfortable with me initially, and then we could maybe tinker a little more with the format.
Although people were expecting real changes, but perhaps part of the problem was that you were perceived as a personality, not a news person. Of course, many people would say that a lot of the criticism was simply because you're a woman doing a job that until then had been seen as a man's job, and you were criticized for things that you wore, for your makeup, something a male anchor would never be judged on. But it's the same sort of thing that Hillary Clinton faced from the moment Bill Clinton ran for president on.
Well, I think, there still exists a fair amount of sexism. I don't like to always pull out the sexism card because I think it's complex. I do think that people have become accustomed, or people certainly of my generation and yours, to seeing a white male in that domain and kind of as that sort of patriarchal father figure delivering the news in somber
Walter
tones.
Cronkite.
Yeah, exactly. And I had the privilege of having dinner with Walter before I started at CBS, and
he was just a wonderful
person. Yeah, he said, I've always gotten criticized from the left and the right, and I always thought, well, that means I'm doing a good job. But he was just wonderful and charming. He incredibly generous to spend some time with me. But I think there are a lot of different reasons. But I have said before that sexism, I think, is sort of still accepted in some ways where other kinds of discrimination aren't, in terms of kind of our cultural conditioning. But, listen, I think that women are more interesting to evaluate, no offense, Leonard, in terms of their appearance. And I think, as I said, it was a novelty and people were paying attention. And I think this is the way of the world. And I think Laura Lenny's right. I think you can't let outside influences affect the way you feel about yourself. And you just have to forge ahead and be professional and be the person you are and understand there were reasons why you were hired to do a particular job.
What about what Cronkite talked about, being criticized from both the right and the left? Is that something that you kept in the back of your mind when you were writing some of your reports?
Not really.
If I say it this way, if I say Obamacare, that immediately suggests that I'm using a Republican buzzword. If I only say a woman's right to choose rather than something that anti-abortion people would say, right to life or whatever, that again, I'm going to be offending some people?
Well, we take great pains to make our copy and the way we do our pieces fair, accurate, and appropriate. So we would never say Obamacare, just because obviously it had become a Republican buzzword and a pejorative description of healthcare reform. We call it what it is, healthcare reform. In terms of abortion issues, we call it pro-abortion or anti-abortion. We're very clinical and definitive about those things. But so I think I've been trained all my life to do that. So it's not something it's something I'm aware of, but it's not something I think about every single day.
A lot of the advice in this book is about not letting fear stop you, not being afraid. But how do you avoid being afraid? There are times when it's almost a good thing to be afraid.
I think it's smart to be cautious, but not necessarily fearful. I think the point that a lot of people make in the book, whether it's Anna Quinlan or, a host of other people who talked about this, is that, that I think it's sort of under the headline of no guts, no glory. You have to take chances in life. You have to take risks. If you're going to be safe all the time and cautious every single day, then you're not going to get out of your comfort zone. You're not going to even try things that you may be passionate about, that may excite you, and quite frankly, that you may be really good at.
So were you
like
feeling
the man in the arena that Teddy Roosevelt wrote so eloquently.
So were you feeling too comfortable on the Today Show by the
time
you left?
No, I mean, I love loved doing the Today Show, and I did it for 15 years.
Yeah, but you were in a real comfort zone there.
And
the challenge of doing something else might have made you a little afraid, but at the same time, there's something exciting about it.
Oh, yeah. I think fear is a great motivator, and I think it's, can really inspire you to make changes in your life. So, yeah, I was very comfortable at the Today Show, but I also, as I said, had done it for 15 years, and I was ready for a new challenge. I think most people after 15 years would probably feel the same way.
Did the anchor position turn out to be more static than you'd been used to?
Static in what way?
Well, most days you're just sitting there or standing in front of
a
desk. And on the Today Show, you were doing all sorts of
running out to the plaza and talking to people.
And cooking with people and doing all sorts of other stuff.
Yeah, but we did a lot of serious interviews on the Today Show. David Duke, Lee Iacocca, Yasser Arafat, world leaders. So people may think of the Today Show in that vein, but, we really set the news agenda in many ways and did a lot of very serious political interviews. So I have to defend the Today Show in that way. But, I tried and continue to try to do a lot of reporting as an evening news anchor. I went to Haiti. I go down to Capitol Hill. I'm probably going to do a piece on new members of Congress after 100 days. I interviewed them right after they were sworn in to talk about their impressions, their frustrations, and their experiences. I go out in the field quite a bit. So I think that has really kept me jazzed about the job. I think if I was just sitting at a desk day in and day out, that I love to report. I love to talk to people. And I do quite a few interviews from the desk, from the anchor desk. So I feel like I enjoy the job a great deal because I'm able to not make it sort of a static situation.
Katie Couric has written a book called The Best Advice I Ever Got, Lessons from Extraordinary Lives. It's published by Random House. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break for, guess what? The news.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Katie Couric is the anchor and managing editor of the CBS Evening News with Katie Couric. She's a 60 Minutes correspondent and anchor of CBS News primetime specials. She's covered most of the major breaking news events over the past 15 years, including, we'll talk about in a little while, the historic presidential election of 2008, September 11th attacks, the Columbine tragedy, the Oklahoma City bombing, and the funeral of Princess Diana. And none of that is at the center of this book she's just written.
That's for my next book, Leonard.
That's going to be the big memoir?
Yeah. And my father said, if you write a memoir, wait till you're a little bit older and write it yourself. Don't get any help, because a lot of people, as you know, have co-writers or ghostwriters. And my dad is a former journalist himself. He wrote for the Atlanta Constitution, before that the Macon Telegraph, and then for United Press. And he's a brilliant writer. So I made that promise to him. So one day I hope to sit down and write a book about my life, because it's been much more interesting than I ever anticipated.
Well, many people were surprised at how beautifully written Barack Obama's memoir was, although Donald Trump believes it was written by somebody else.
Yes, I heard
that. The same guy who forged the birth certificate. But anyway, that's another matter altogether. What happens when you have to tell some of those stories? Can you do it with a straight face?
Yes, I can, actually. And I have to, because I'm on television and not on radio.
That's right. I could be smiling when I'm saying
something. Yeah, nobody knows.
Really,
you
tragic.
Could be. Yeah, yeah. Who knows?
When did you know that working in TV news was what you wanted to do?
Well, I worked in radio while I was going to the University of Virginia. For 3 summers, I worked at WAVA, which was an all-news radio station in Washington, and then I worked at WASH in the news division, and then at WMAQ, and they put me in sales because they thought I would do really well in sales, which I didn't particularly like.
But did you do well?
Well, I was a college student. I just sort of tagged around with actual account executives, but I realized that that wasn't really what excited me. So I've always loved to write. I love people. I'm curious and very outgoing. So I thought the combination of liking to write, being good at writing under pressure, because I'm a master procrastinator, and being interested in other people, I thought journalism would be a great profession for me. And after college, I thought, well, gee, television might be more lucrative, quite frankly, than radio. And it would be interesting to work with visuals. I think radio is really fun because it's a very solitary if you're a reporter. You're kind of on your own. You're responsible. You're splicing the tape. I don't know if they even still do that.
We don't splice tape,
but back in the day, yeah. You splice tape. But and it was actually exciting because you were so independent. But I thought it would be fun to work with photographers and editors and all sorts of people and have a collaborative process in putting pieces together.
But not everybody is a natural on camera, at least the first time. I have a friend, Melba Tolliver, who was thrown into being a newswoman just because it was a strike, actually. And she was a natural and wound up with a TV career. She had been a nurse who was then, for a little while, I guess, was working in the NBC offices. But other people, it does take a while, and it took a little while for you.
Oh, definitely.
To get it going,
I was going
to
say I was definitely not a natural. I was awkward. I didn't feel very comfortable on television. I looked very young when I was in my 20s. I looked quite young. I remember going on CNN and having one of the anchors say in my earpiece during the commercial break, "Who is that girl? She looks like she's about 12 years old." And I was so deflated. And, you know, I had a lot of naysayers early in my career saying, you know, I had nobody kind of taking me under their wing and saying, "We're going to help you. We're going to develop you professionally." I kind of had to do it on my own and was very scrappy about it. I did have a husband and wife anchor team at CNN who were very supportive, named Don Farmer and Chris Curl. But I had to work very hard. And I think like any job, you get better, as Malcolm Gladwell says in Outliers, you know, it takes 10,000 hours to become proficient in anything. And so I think the more I did it, the better I became, the more relaxed I became. But I definitely wasn't a natural. And I hope that will encourage other people in whatever line of work they're pursuing to know that it's not always instantaneous.
And your book is full of advice about not giving up.
Yeah.
But have you looked at some of the old tape?
Oh, God.
I'm afraid to listen to early radio shows I did because I know it's something like, well, here I am. It's midnight.
I don't know. I bet you were good at the beginning. Did you have a hard time?
Well, I did a show at midnight, from midnight to 5.
So you had to be very mellow?
Yeah. Well, I was probably more mellow than I should have been putting people to sleep.
But I know I have some old videotape of myself, but I haven't watched it in a long time. But once in a while when they do retrospectives, for example, at the Today Show, I did see some pieces of me in the early days. And it's kind of shocking because it's amazing that I thought I actually looked good at the time. But I was, you know, I was much greener, and that's okay.
Let's talk a bit about ratings, because ratings, unfortunately, have been a part of the story of your time at CBS. Now, when you came in, took over CBS Evening News, the show was rated third of the top three. And for a little while, it rose and then it fell and then it was back up for a while. But do you have any theories as to why CBS, which dominates TV ratings in the evening, has done so poor on the news ever since, I guess, Dan Rather?
Well, I think "does so poor" is a bit of an overstatement. We have 6.5 million people watching every night, which I'm really proud of, and I feel a huge amount of responsibility toward those viewers. I don't know. There are all sorts of theories about it, and I'll leave that to the analysts.
But you do have the best demographics for advertisers, don't you?
Well, in prime time, we do really well. But I think there are a lot of things that are involved. Like, it's interesting. Sometimes I think that the strength of the local lead-in before the show comes on, some people say that has an impact. And it can have a very positive impact. For example, here in New York, Channel 2 does very well, and we beat the NBC Nightly News in New York City because they are very strong local broadcasts. So we have them to thank in New York City, but conversely in other places, it's a different situation. I think there are a whole panoply of reasons why, you know, it's been in third place. Everyone says that it kind of really changes very, very slowly, that habits are very deeply ingrained. But as I said, I've always focused on the quality of the show. And, you know, in this fragmented media landscape, the fact that 6.5 million people are watching every single night, as I said, it's a real honor for me.
Well, I when I said the demographics, I understand you have the youngest audience, which is a good thing in a medium where the people are very concerned about the fact that young people are not going to television.
Yeah, well, I think clearly the way people are consuming news and information has changed dramatically. But I've tried to embrace new media in a way that maybe has made some younger viewers gravitate to our program. We've included questions that we get on Twitter, for example, about the Gulf oil spill, or Facebook. I've done a web show every week. I interview somebody on my web show that runs exclusively at CBSNews.com. So, you know, again, I've just never been one of those people who dwells on the ratings. To me, it's all about the quality of the broadcast, doing the best job I possibly can, shining a spotlight on all the talented correspondents and producers we have on our air every single night. And that's really what drives me and motivates me. I know that, you know, people look at ratings and they matter, but it's just something that has never motivated me professionally.
A listener left a comment on our show page. When my kids were little, they thought every woman on the radio or TV was Katie Couric because the only TV show I watched was Today. Once when my daughter Simone was two, she got fed up listening to news in the car radio and she yelled, "Blah, blah, 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 blah. We heard it, lady." My four-year-old son, Ellis, was deeply shocked by this outburst and said, "Simone, don't speak to Katie like that."
So every news person was Katie. Well, I like that. I like that.
But you contribute to 60 Minutes. Mm-hmm. Is that one of the reasons the move to CBS was so appealing to you?
Well, I think 60 Minutes has the finest journalism on television by far, week in and week out. All the pieces are, in my opinion, excellent. I've been very impressed by how much time and attention to detail is spent on every single piece and the level of professionalism. They're all journalists over there. It's not just the reporters out in the field, the producers, the associate producers, the researchers. And it's a show that I've always watched and always loved. And so I have felt very privileged to be a part of that program when I have been able to.
And you also get an opportunity to work long form.
Yeah, which is great. You know, for example, I'm doing a profile of Secretary Gates, as I mentioned. So, you know, to have 12 or 14 minutes to really dig in to a story and really try to do a revealing interview, an important interview, that's a wonderful opportunity on television these days when segments seem to get shorter and shorter.
You were the first to interview Captain Chesley Sullenberger, who landed the U.S. Airways plane in the Hudson. And you mentioned that interview, which earned an Emmy for 60 Minutes in your book. I interviewed him once. I know he was one of the really easy interviews of my life. He was very
easy to talk to. He's a man of few words, right?
Yeah, but at the same time, he really speaks very well.
Oh, he's wonderful.
I've been thinking about some of the politicians that I've had to interview, and I suspect you've had more problems than I because you've spoken to so many more of them. They're really adept at avoiding giving a real answer to your questions, or if they give you what I call parallel answers. You ask them a question, and they take one word out of that question, Afghanistan, and then they say what they want to say about Afghanistan, but don't answer the question that you've asked. How do you deal with that?
Well, first of all, I think that I can't impress upon you the importance of doing follow-up questions. I think in this day and age, sometimes people allow politicians to be circumlocutious, one of my favorite words, and not directly answer a query by any kind of journalist. And I think that, you know, our responsibility is politely, respectfully, but firmly hold their feet to the fire. So if someone doesn't answer a question, I used to say on the Today Show, "I'm sorry, Senator, but you didn't answer my question." I'd re-ask it, and maybe the third time, and I would try and try again. But I think it's also critically important to listen to the answer, to not be focused on the next question, because in television, you know, if you have 5 seconds of silence, it's like an eternity. So I think people worry about, okay, where am I taking this next? And sometimes that prohibits them from really listening to the answer and following up.
You also want to get to all of the important questions. And so somebody says something ridiculous.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
And you just let it go.
They filibuster, too, sometimes, because they know that if they eat up time, you know, that you're not going to get to as many issues as you want to address. And similarly, I think it's interesting because I think the trap that some politicians fall in, if you don't follow up right away and you just let them continue talking, sometimes they will ultimately answer the question because you're not so quick to interrupt and they want to fill the empty spaces.
Your interview with Sarah Palin in 2008 was seen as a breakthrough for you at CBS. You won a DuPont Award for that interview. Do you think that it reminded people of your skills as an interviewer?
Possibly.
Would you have done something similar at the Today Show?
Definitely. Definitely. I mean, as I said before, I did so many serious expanded interviews on the Today Show, whether it was family members of Columbine victims or world leaders. So I definitely think the Today Show would have afforded me the time to do that kind of interview with Governor Palin, just as the Evening News did.
The McCain-Palin campaign accused you of practicing gotcha journalism. What's your response to that?
I don't think the campaign did. I think probably Governor Palin did following the interview. I think it was not I think universally accepted that that was a fair interview, that I asked questions that voters needed to know the answer to. And I didn't hear a lot of complaints immediately following the interview. I think later there were complaints about it. But, you know, I think it was very fair. And I think that that's kind of a tired fallback thing to say if someone didn't fare well in an interview, that it was a gotcha interview, because I don't think any of the questions were gotcha questions. My goal in that interview was to reveal where Governor Palin stood on a number of very complicated policy issues that are facing the country that we really hadn't heard her position on. So I think that I would have asked any candidate similar questions, and I think it was extremely fair.
Does any bit of advice in your books stand out for you as the one that would be most relevant to your experience?
Oh, gosh, there's so much good advice, honestly. I think, you know, I really get something from almost every essay. Larry King and Steven Spielberg talk about the importance of being a good listener. You know, some of the advice I've included that I've gotten through the years is someone at the Today Show said to me, a boat is always safe in the harbor, but that's not what boats are built for. And another very funny kind of crusty old producer said to me when I was going from Pentagon correspondent to the Today Show, he said, listen, kid, today you may be drinking the wine. Tomorrow you could be picking the grapes. And that always stuck with me. And I thought that's really good advice. I like Linda Ellerbee's, some days you're the statue and some days you're the pigeon. And I like my parents' advice, which is do the best you can. And, you know, Jimmy Carter wrote about that with Admiral Rickover. And so I think there are little tidbits and little pieces of advice that, you know, even though at our age, I don't know how old you are, Leonard, but I'm 54.
I'm older than you.
You are? Gosh, I would never expect that. But that, you know, that kind of remind us of the importance of certain values in our lives and reaffirm how we live our lives.
Just one more thing. Newspapers are shrinking and jobs throughout the media are shrinking, although a lot of people are taking it upon themselves to get involved. What advice would you give to somebody? I'm sure people ask you all the time, what do I do to get into this business and how can you succeed today?
Well, I think obviously, as I mentioned earlier, people are consuming information in very different ways. That's one of the reasons that fewer people are watching the evening news, because news is available to them online 24/7. But, I mean, it sounds a little corny, but I think that they really do have to learn the basic tenets of good journalism. They have to learn how to do good research. They have to educate themselves on a whole variety of subjects so they know something about a lot of things. If they're going to be a generalist, they have to learn how to do a good interview. They need to develop good sources. These are all, I think, timeless qualities that are required to be a good journalist. And then I would say make sure you get with an organization that has a strong internet presence and is expanding and is visionary and is really kind of thinking of new ways to deliver good content.
Well, I don't know what's going to happen in your career. I'm sure it's going to turn out fine, but take that advice as well. Go somewhere where there's a strong internet presence.
Yeah.
Katie Kirk, The Best Advice I Ever Got, Lessons from Extraordinary Lives, is published by Random House. It's been a great pleasure talking with you today.
Thank you so much, Leonard.